This is Law and Disorder.
Lynn Stewart, our friend and comrade, is coming up for sentencing September 25th. The government has recommended 30 years.
A legal and political outrage, sending a message of fear into the heart of every lawyer who tries to defend their client.
We'll bring you the voices of the lawyers who are suing the government for keeping state secrets.
When you sue the government now, whether it's for Guantanamo, torture, or national security wiretapping, they say to the court, you can't hear this case. It's a state secret.
All across America, police officers are armed with weapons that shoot 50,000 volts of electricity into civilians.
Already 175 people have died from these weapons. You'll hear about one specific case of a person who died in L.A.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Next, we bring you excerpts from a panel of lawyers who are suing the government for asserting the state secrets privilege. What is this privilege, and why should we be concerned about it? State secrets have been used by the Bush administration to dismiss public interest lawsuits, such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation lawsuit challenging the legality of the NSA's domestic spying program. In another lawsuit, the wrongfully accused and tortured victim, Maher Arar, sought to sue Attorney General John Ashcroft for his role in deporting him to Syria to face torture and to extract false confessions. More recently, the Justice Department moved to preempt the Center for Constitutional Rights' challenge to warrantless domestic surveillance by invoking the state secrets privilege. The Bush administration argues that CCR's case could reveal secrets regarding United States national security, and thus the presiding judge must dismiss it without reviewing the evidence. The panel was moderated by Amy Goodman. We now hear an excerpt from a speech by Bill Goodman, legal director with the Center for Constitutional Rights, where he's led a team of attorneys challenging some of the worst excesses of the Bush administration since September 11. Some of the landmark cases include representing Guantanamo detainees before the Supreme Court. Goodman was one of the first to take on the Patriot Act and have a portion of it ruled unconstitutional. He also sued against private military contractors at Abu Ghraib. This recording is a little off mic, so please bear with us.
I won't speak long, but I want to frame the discussion in terms of what the broader issues are that we're talking about when we talk about state secrets, this claim of state secrets and democracy. One of the great benefits of being able to sue the government for illegal or unconstitutional behavior is that if you manage to state a case and get past the initial phases of the litigation, sooner or later somebody, somewhere in power is going to be asked some questions which they will have to answer. The subject matter is sensitive. Courts can fashion protective orders so that it does not become widely known publicly. But nonetheless, at the end of the day, the question will be asked, and the person to whom it is asked is going to have to give an answer. Why did you do this? Why did you shoot this person? Why did you drop a bomb on this house? Why did you wiretap this person without a warrant? Those are questions that will be asked and that have to be answered. The great chronicler of American democracy, in the early 19th century. Lex Tocqueville noted this as one of the unique and great aspects of American democracy. It is therefore particularly troublesome that in the past 6 years of the Bush administration, we are now regularly confronted and uniquely confronted with this state secrets claim. We can shorten it and simply call it the SS claim. We'll all understand what we're talking about. And this has come up in case after case in really a historic and unprecedented level. And it's challenging not simply state secrets in the sense of these are the engineering blueprints for nuclear weapons, or these are the silos where our missiles are located. No, it's not those kinds of state secrets at all. The state secrets which it is invoked to cover up and to conceal can only be described as one outrage after another. The torture of Mayor Arar that will be discussed at length. Massive wiretapping of Americans in the tens, hundreds of thousands, or millions. All of these things are now publicly known, but at the same time not subject to being scrutinized through litigation because of the claim of state secrets. Because somebody who otherwise would have to answer a question no longer has to.
This recording is a little off mic, so please bear with us. There was some ambient noise in the room where it was recorded, but what Shane Cadedil from the Center for Constitutional Rights has to say is very important. He breaks down the history of the state secrets privilege and how the Bush administration is using it. Shane has worked on a number of cases since September 11, including two cases in which citizens were detained as enemy combatants, and a case on behalf of a class of hundreds of immigrants held in detention long after their final deportation. He's also counsel on CCR's pending challenge to the NSA's warrantless surveillance program in the Center for Constitutional Rights versus Bush.
Hi, everyone. I guess the thing I'm going to try to explain, and hopefully this will be all very clear, and then I think the next two members of the panel are going to talk about some specific cases, but I'm going to talk in general about how the state secrets privilege works in lawsuits, where it came from, you know, what its historical origins are, and how this administration is using it in kind of a general sense. The state secrets privilege is what we call a common law evidentiary privilege, meaning it's something that was created by judges. And it permits a government to block discovery in a lawsuit of any information that, if it were disclosed, would adversely affect national security. So how does this work in practice? Well, basically, the government invokes the state secrets privilege by submitting an affidavit, a little piece of paper signed, essentially saying that everything in there is true, from a department head, so someone who's like a cabinet-level official in the executive branch. And this affidavit says that that allowing the information that someone is seeking through discovery or some other means in a court case, allowing that information into the case would one, risk disclosure of secrets, and those secrets are two things that are so sensitive that they would threaten grave damage to national security if they did get out. So there's two elements there: one, that there's a risk of disclosure if the secret information were allowed into a case, and two, that the secret is important enough that it would threaten grave damage to the national security. And according to the government, basically, once this cabinet-level official comes into the case and writes out a little declaration saying this. Once that happens, the evidence is supposed to be completely barred from use in the case. So it's as if the evidence didn't exist, or as some cases say, the same as if a witness had died, unavailable to the person who's suing the government in the case. Now, previous invocations of the privilege by the government have usually been at the discovery stage. So this is the stage where the parties are kind of exchanging facts. So if you're suing the government, you go and you ask them questions and interrogatories that they're supposed to respond to in writing, or you make document requests, that kind of thing. And so at this discovery stage, the government typically comes in and asks the courts to deny somebody access to documents or witnesses. And in very rare circumstances, the government has argued that the case itself has to be dismissed entirely. But, you know, sometimes the government will come in and say, you know, look, you can't give, you know, the people suing us certain evidence, and without that evidence, they can't win their case. So you've got to dismiss the case on those grounds. You know, but more recently, the government has come in and really said, look, this case can't go forward at all. And some examples of this are Anne and Maria's torture rendition cases. The government has come in at the very beginning of the case, at the pleading stage, before anyone has made any requests for documents or information, and has said, you know, look, the very subject matter that's at issue in this case is so inherently secretive that we can't have any proceedings go forward. We can't let the plaintiffs try to prove their case based on public information. We can't just say that they can't discover anything from us. The case just has to end, period, because what the plaintiffs are challenging is just inherently a secret. So, you know, they'll say the torture rendition program is inherently a secret, or our wiretapping cases. And the fact that the government is carrying on this kind of program is inherently a secret. There are lots of cases, run-of-the-mill cases, criminal cases, for instance, where the government, where courts manage to have a trial even when some of the information is sensitive. So organized crime trials, say, where some of the witnesses are inside informers and you can't disclose their identity, that kind of thing. And courts have a lot of procedures in place to allow for these kind of trials to go forward without that sensitive information coming out. So a judge can close a courtroom, they can place all the paper filings under seal so that the public can't get them. They can even make the other side's attorneys promise not to divulge various pieces of information or even seek security clearances sometimes. I mean, that's not unprecedented. But according to the government's interpretation of the state secrets privilege, even all those sort of measures combined are not enough to protect certain secrets. In some cases, the material is so sensitive that the judge himself can't be allowed to see it. And that's why you have this process whereby the cabinet official comes in and writes out a little declaration. Because it's not the sort of situation where the cabinet official would produce for the judge's eyes only the actual sort of secret documents that they were trying to keep out of the case. Instead, you get a cabinet official writing about what they claim is sort of a general description of the secret documents, and then saying, this stuff is so secret I can't even show it to you, Your Honor. So whether or not the risk of disclosure is in fact real, and whether or not grave damage to national security is going to result if there is disclosure, these are all things that aren't things that a judge is going to make a judgment about. They're basically things that the executive official who's writing out the affidavit are going to make a judgment about. And that, according to the government, that judgment is conclusive. A cabinet official, John Negroponte in our case, the director of National Intelligence, comes in, says, I can't release any information about this this NSA wiretapping program, and the judge is supposed to accept that as conclusive and shut down the case. The judge is not, according to the government, not supposed to be able to call Negroponte in and ask him questions. He's not supposed to be able to ask Negroponte to produce the documents on which he's relying to make that kind of judgment. And this is the case, according to the government, even if there are allegations of unlawful or unconstitutional actions at issue. So that's the government's account of the state secrets privilege. As you can tell from that account, it basically is saying that the executive branch gets to come in and tell judges, dictate to federal judges, what cases they can hear and can't hear. It seems counter to the very idea of an independent judiciary. And you might wonder, where did this come from? How did it get into our law? Well, I think you won't be surprised to hear that it happened during the Cold War, essentially. And the case that established the privilege is called United States versus Reynolds, a 1953 case involving the crash of a B-29 bomber with some allegedly sensitive intelligence equipment on it, electronic eavesdropping equipment on it. And in deciding the case, the Supreme Court noted that there hadn't been very much experience with the state secrets privilege in our country, but in England there was a very extensive experience with it. And so essentially the Supreme Court imported the state secrets privilege directly from English law, from a case called Duncan v. Kamel that was ruled on during World War II in England. The court basically took its standards almost entirely directly from the Duncan case. And they did so without really giving very much attention to real serious differences between the structure of English government and our government. So, the British government is organized around the principle of parliamentary supremacy. It's basically a one-branch system of government. So British judges do review statutes for compliance with the unwritten constitution, but all they do is issue what's called a statement of incompatibility. Unlike our courts, which routinely declare that laws are completely unconstitutional, and people expect that that's the last word on that. In England, if Parliament decides it doesn't like the ruling of the House of Lords, it can basically ignore it. It can pass a law doing the same thing, or essentially saying that the ruling should be ignored. And Parliament has the last word. Similarly, the Prime Minister isn't somebody who's elected directly by the people like our President is. He's someone who's essentially appointed by Parliament. He's the head of the majority party in Parliament. And the highest court in England, the Law Lords, is technically a committee of the upper house of their parliament. So really they've got a one-branch system of government. So we shouldn't be surprised that in their system, they occasionally are willing to allow that there are state secrets cases where where the executive essentially gets to trump judicial review, because essentially, you know, the executive is an agent of parliament. Parliament's got all the power. You know, so how has the Bush administration been using this doctrine? Well, you know, Reynolds is pretty typical of an older sort of state secrets case. It involves, you know, a crash of a military aircraft. A lot of state secrets cases prior to this current administration involved disputes between military contractors or cases that involved somehow, you know, death or a tort suit coming out of military action. You know, I'll talk a little bit about the Reynolds case because it's interesting. This plane crashed, it had electronic surveillance equipment on it, and the widows of three civilians who were on board to monitor the electronic surveillance equipment had sued the government, claiming that the crash was due to negligence. The government had an accident report. The widows came in and requested this accident report. Government refused to turn it over and claimed state secrets. You know, government said basically, you know, this report contained information about the secret mission that this was on, and, you know, sort of implied that the surveillance equipment was described in this document. Well, 52 years later, the document was declassified, and it turned out that it showed nothing about the electronic equipment or about the mission or the testing of the equipment, the mission that the plane itself was on. Instead, it showed two significant things, that the plane was defective, that it was a maintenance problem from the day that they had gotten it, and that nobody had trained the civilian employees on how to bail out of the plane. In fact, a couple of people on the plane managed to open their parachutes and get out. The civilians didn't and died. So really, it showed exactly what the plaintiffs were trying to prove, that there was negligence. There was not a single thing in there that could be construed as a state secret. You know, and I think that's pretty characteristic of pre-Bush administration state secrets cases. A lot of times the invocation of the privilege appeared to be a way of stopping a lawsuit that might have exposed military contractor waste, overruns, that kind of thing, or negligence by the government. What's new in the last few years is not so much that the privilege is being invoked more frequently, but that it's being invoked more broadly in the cases where the government is invoking it. So, you know, in the past, you know, again, it's the privilege has been invoked to keep a specific piece of evidence out of the case. And if the government asks for dismissal, it's because they claim that without that piece of evidence, you can't prove your case. Now we're seeing a lot more of the sort of thing that we've seen in our wiretapping case. Government comes in and says the very topic here is off limits to the judiciary. You know, or we can't defend ourselves. We need facts that are state secrets in order to disprove the plaintiff's claims. So we can't mount a defense, and the whole case has to end. That kind of thing. And that's a case even where there are important constitutional or human rights violations, like in the torture rendition cases that Anne and Maria are going to talk about. Even in national security whistleblower cases, where it might be in the best interests of the American people or of the nation as a whole to air out what the plaintiff is trying to prove in open court, like Anne's case on behalf of Seibel Edmonds, and also to other post 9/11 cases involving executive law breaking that's very clear on its face, like our case against the NSA wiretapping program. I'll mention one other thing that's sort of new with the Bush administration, which is that in a lot of these cases, they've argued that even if the court were going to go beyond the executive affidavit and look at the underlying evidence, that courts really aren't qualified to look at the evidence. They've said that intelligence is sort of like a mosaic, composed of lots of tiny little pieces of information, and that the information, sometimes these little pieces may be the most innocuous seeming thing, but that intelligence experts are capable of assembling lots of tiny little pieces like this into something that shows a more, you know, sort of serious sort of overall picture, something that's more, you know, more obviously, you know, secret of state. And that, you know, the implication is that, you know, a judge reviewing something that the government claims is a secret might look at it and think this is a tiny little innocuous piece of nothing. But that if that were revealed to our enemies, they might be able to fit that in and it'd be the one missing piece in the jigsaw puzzle and would let them know something secret. Well, obviously, this is a principle that doesn't have any limitation. But there are courts that have bought it in the past, this so-called mosaic theory.
During this year's Amnesty International's general meeting in Portland, Oregon, Law and Disorder co-host Dahlia Hashad and producer Jeff Brady collected audio from various interviews, panels, and rallies being held at the 2006 general meeting. In this recording, many Amnesty International staff members and activists gathered to speak out, listen, and share their stories. We go now to an audio compilation from the anti-torture rally in Portland's historic Pioneer Square.
Is this the sweet land of liberty of which we sing? We are here to say, stop torture, stop renditions, and give us back our country.
Amnesty started with a commitment not to forget prisoners, and we're not going to forget countries. But we are going to work on this country because there's so much at stake.
I don't think we need to make some noise. We need to raise our voices. We need to yell. We need to yell and make a lot of noise.
Come on.
I believe that it's our duty to write to our senators, lobby our congressmen, send out letters, and tell them that we want this stopped.
What kind of government of country is that that feels entitled?
I don't know. Just the disregard for human life, for the dignity of every human being, no matter where they live.
Torture,
sensory deprivation.
Not only their own citizens, but citizens from other countries.
He was imprisoned in Somalia from 69 to 81, subject to torture, electric shock, blindfolded, dunked in the sea. He subsequently spent 1 year in isolation in a dark room, humid, with salt on the floor.
In case that's not enough for you, the rules can change literally at any time. They've been changed by press conferences. They've been changed by Congress in the middle of the night. They've been changed by what they call POMs. Completely non-existent in the legal world. It's a presiding officer memorandum. A presiding officer is sort of like a judge who oversees this sort of trial in Guantanamo over what are alleged to be war crimes.
So we have to decide whether we will let fear govern us or whether we want moral people governing us.
You know, my answer is that's definitely a terrorist government. It's a terrorist state.
So this is the type of respect we've seen from this administration for the rule of law. If you don't like the rules, you kind of throw them up and make up your own.
What do you encourage Americans to do? You're clearly an example, all of you are example of people who are actively engaging both your government and your citizenry. What would you encourage the thousands of people listening to this broadcast to do?
Do the appropriate thing, or things, plural, and impeach Bush. You got to impeach him.
Okay, we got 998 days left until January 20th, 2008. So how much can we get done in that amount of time? Because JFK's administration was 1,000 days. And I've been counting down since before the election.
You know, my predecessor, Bill Shultz, on whose very broad shoulders I'm going to be standing, always liked to remind us of something. That is that the arc of the universe bends towards justice, and that what we have to do is hold on tightly to that.
Then you've got to clean up our system. You've got to make sure that the Republicans don't get back into power until they are worthy of it. You've got to make sure the Democratic Party doesn't sit to the right of center and gets back to what it should be, which is a party of the people with the people's interest.
Tell us why you're here, why you came all the way from New Jersey, Hackensack, New Jersey, here to all across the country, to Portland, Oregon, to be here today.
Well, I came here to be part of the hundreds of voices that would tell our government that we cannot.
Immediately after I learned about amnesty, I knew that human rights were something that was really important to me, and I wanted to get into it as much as possible. So I, after going to the meeting in Boston, the regional meeting, I realized I was going to do everything possible to get to the national meeting because I want to have a say in this.
We cannot continue our policy that we torture, that we render prisoners out to countries that condone torture. We cannot continue to do this and still say that we're the leader in democracy and freedom all around the world.
This is something I want to continue throughout my life, so I would like to start as soon as possible.
Why do you want to have a say in it? Why is that important to you?
because it's something that really affects everybody if you think about it. I'm leading a cluster at my school, an out front cluster, and LGBT rights are something that affect everybody at our school. If you just walk down the hallways, hate speech, that's a violation of human rights, and I want to put an end to that.
I'm a teacher at the Bergen County Academies in Hackensack, New Jersey. Amnesty is one of the biggest activities in our whole school. This generation of high school students is becoming really activists, and it's not something that's really sort of gotten into the radar yet. You don't really see it on the press, but the movement is out there. You can really see it as a teacher among students.
Why do you think students are becoming so active now?
Well, I think part of it has to do with 9/11. People started to really focus on what was going on around the world. You know, our students are from the New York area, and so some of them were impacted directly by that. And that's been compounded, in my opinion, by the internet, because people can get better information and they can challenge the information that is inaccurate.
I'm wearing handcuffs to show my solidarity with the prisoners and everyone who's dealing with this injustice that's going on. And then on my arms I have written "Dignity for All" real big in black. Because it's not justice for all, it's dignity for all. I mean, exactly. If it's not something we would do to our own people, we cannot justify it for other people. We cannot.
People wonder sort of how did we get here? How did we get to the point where we're trying to talk about how do we get the U.S. government to stop justifying torture? I would assert that this is an administration who forgot the rule of law. They created a category of enemy combatants, which is supposed to be a group of people that are so bad that they don't actually have any rights that exist in the law, just the rules that the U.S. government decides to apply to them at any given time.
Tom?
Well, just I think the main point is that, you know, we just all gotta treat each other the same way, you know, pretty much the golden rule all the way around. You know, we all bleed red.
Do you think it's as bad as we know? Is it worse?
Oh, I absolutely believe it's worse. I mean, you never know everything that's going on until long into history. And what we're seeing is just the surface of what's actually going on. And it's tearing my heart out. I mean, I have a brother who's over fighting in Iraq. And if this turns around on him, I'll lose my mind. I'll lose my mind. And I've already lost my faith in my country. What else do I have to lose, you know?
I'm absolutely with her on that. You know, I mean, she couldn't even said it better.
Are you all here from here in Portland, locally?
Yeah.
Are you involved in Amnesty International or other local groups?
Yeah, I've been involved with Amnesty International, really just from the sidelines more than anything. I'm trying to get more involved with things, and I just recently, you know, decided to take some time off from working and stuff in order to get more active in the political scene.
Personally, I believe that first and foremost is that people need to be aware of the fact that this stuff is going on in our society. They need to be aware, they need to be able to confront our leaders that represent us as a country and decide for us our values. And they need to be aware that the torture and these actions, they don't, they're not the American values that we all cherish.
It was really brought home to me during the demonstration today when people wearing orange jumpsuits with black hoods walked silently through the crowd in chains. And seeing these people as apparitions walking through the crowd made me realize that these people are among us. We're haunted by the fact that people are being tortured by the U.S. government, that they're being taken onto planes from our cities and brought to other places to torture. It's not far, far away. It's right here.
king of cowboys. Here I
If you have thoughts on this segment, check out our blog, lawanddisorder.org. We'd like to know what you're thinking.
He patrols the highways from the air. He keeps the country safe from long hair. I'm the masculine American man. I kill the
In our last interview in the Law and Disorder Taser series, co-host Dahlia Hashad talked with attorney Paul L. Mills. He's also co-director of LA Police Watch. He explained how police misuse the taser weapon, and specifically the case of a 33-year-old man who, while handcuffed, was stunned by police with a taser and later died. You're going to want to hear all of this interview, because at the end, Mills describes a chilling future plan in which Taser Incorporated may be developing wireless implants that could remotely shock human beings.
Paul, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Paul, I'm so happy to sit here and talk to you and have the opportunity to chat with you, particularly because police misconduct is one of the cornerstones of the Amnesty International USA program format. We think that police misconduct is commonly thought of as a civil rights violation only in the United States. Is there any connection to the human rights violations?
Yes, there's certainly a connection both in fact and in principle. In fact, in most countries, there is a military or police component to government oppression. And then there is the principle of the idea that we as human beings face all kinds of tragedy from nature. It's when our own governments turn against us that the fight for human rights and civil rights begins. And that oppression typically takes the form of police or military.
You work specifically in LA. Tell us, what are some of your cases in LA? What are you seeing there?
Well, over the past few years, I've tended to specialize to some extent in police homicides. And the case I'm working now is the case of Alvarado versus City of Los Angeles and Taser. The decedent was handcuffed and tasered extensively.
Tell us what specifically happened in your particular case, because as you mentioned, Amnesty has been working extensively on taser use and abuse.
Okay, this is perhaps a textbook example of how the taser can lead to a tragic result. The decedent was agitated. His mother called for an ambulance. The 911 operator extracted from her a justification for calling the police. The fire department paramedics showed up first. They were able to talk to the decedent, Mr. Eddie Alvarado, and calm him down. He went into seizure. He was unconscious when the police arrived. They handcuffed him.
While he was unconscious, they handcuffed him.
Yes, that's right. They felt that because of his prior agitation, it was possible that he would wake up and become agitated again and violent. Their role at that point was to transport Mr. Alvarado about one block to the emergency room, which was 30 seconds away, so that he could be treated for his condition. What happened after that is in dispute in some regards, but one thing is certain. The non-shooting officer has stated to police investigators that before he went on shift, he tested the taser to make sure the battery was fresh, and that in the course of Mr. Alvarado, who was tasered with one of the taser barbs in his chest, in the course of that incident, the taser weapon's battery was exhausted. In other words, the shooting officer emptied the battery into Mr. Alvarado. The manufacturer states that that takes about 60 seconds of tasering. Now, if you have ever seen a video of the taser being used, you'll see that it affects the person being tasered just as you would expect it to if you've ever experimented with a frog in a biology class. The area of the body that where the probe is making contact becomes helplessly paralyzed, rigid, and contracted. It's what medical experts call tetany, a contraction, an uncontrollable contraction of the chest. With the chest muscle, the diaphragm muscle contracted, it's impossible to breathe. Mr. Alvarado had just had a seizure. He was in desperate need of oxygen. He was tasered for a total of 60 seconds, during which he was unable to breathe. Then, as a routine procedure, after he had been tasered, and even though his hands were already handcuffed behind his back, the police applied their knee to his upper back as he lay face down. At some point, the police, quote, noticed, unquote, that he had stopped breathing. He did not regain the ability to breathe and was pronounced dead about an hour later. His mother was in the next room during the incident and was a witness to the sound of the electricity as it affected her son. He was 33 years old, and he was an all-A student at a local college. He just completed an associate degree program.
What a hard story. What a really difficult story. What is your lawsuit seeking?
Well, our lawsuit is seeking accountability by the police officers who used this device completely unnecessarily. There's no reason to use any force of that kind on somebody who's already handcuffed.
It's great that you're here to talk about tasers as, you know, in a conversation about human rights, because Amnesty International has long been saying that taser abuse and misuse is a human rights violation.
The attention being paid to the taser right now is focused on the issue of whether it kills people. Amnesty International rightly also focuses on the fact that it is used for torture. I think that it's not a bad idea to be concerned about a wider possible use of the taser, not very far in the future. Taser is developing, or has developed, a wireless taser. As you know, the taser works by shooting darts barbed like fish hooks into the subject, which are connected by very fine wires to the pistol portion, and by pulling the trigger, a charge of electricity of about 26 watts goes into the subject. Once they perfect a wireless version of this product, it seems plausible as a concern that house arrest prisoners who today wear location anklets will be wearing taser receptors, and that the use of such taser receptors would inevitably expand beyond the population of people on parole or probation. For example, we might see immigration officials offering to allow people into the country as long as they're willing to wear a taser receptor or have one implanted in them. This is a human rights concern which may seem outlandish, But 5 or 10 years ago, the idea that people would be shooting fish hooks into people, followed by 26 watts, just because they aren't obeying an officer's commands briskly enough, would also have been greeted with the same disbelief. From time to time, we defend protesters, and the police will sweep up a bunch of people. Unfortunately, often they're from out of town, and they can't risk defending themselves in a trial. They've come out for a weekend to protest something. They live thousands of miles away. So after bluffing and posturing, the prosecution will offer a deal, which is that the protesters are on probation. Well, it's plausible and foreseeable that part of that probation package would be that people who have been protesting will agree to wear or have implanted in them receptors for tasers, so that if the police see a group of people engaged in activism on the street, the first thing they'll do is utilize their taser broadcast system to immediately disable as many of the protesters as have these receptors in them. In other words, probation by use of the taser will become an absolute terminator of First Amendment activity. The same would be the case with anyone that the police and the courts felt might in the future be a problem. They can put the subject in a position of either agreeing to be in, either going to jail while their case is pending, or agreeing to have a taser receptor or of some kind implanted in them. And in this fashion, the police and the government can remove certain activists from any kind of freedom of speech activity because they've been neutralized by the taser. Somebody who's wearing that kind of an apparatus is just not going to risk getting into trouble again. We could also imagine that this is a choice that people will be offered when they come into the country, that if they want to be permanent resident aliens, because of the war on terrorism, we have to give them the option of either staying in the country they're coming from or wearing a some kind of implant during a probationary period of days or months or years, which renders that segment of the population completely vulnerable to absolute control by the police. Or we can imagine that for their own protection, troublesome students or people with mental disabilities will have this kind of technology integrated into their bodies so that they can be protected from harming themselves or others by squeezing a trigger, which is exactly what the justification was in the case which I'm litigating, that the police allege that even though Mr. Alvarado was seated on the floor, had just recovered from a seizure, and had his hands cuffed behind his back, the police were afraid that he might injure himself by banging his head against the wall or a nearby mirror. So they had to use the taser to protect him from himself. Amnesty International has documented evidence that the taser is being used for purposes of compliance. That's pretty clear evidence of where the police intend to go with their use of the taser.
I really think that's what's coming next. I mean, it is the next natural step in this direction that we're heading with taser. For those of you who are hearing some background noise, we're in the basement of the Roseland Theater with Paul L. Mills, who's been kind enough to sit down with us. He is preparing for trial in an important case. He is representing the mother of a man who died after being shot by a taser for over 60 seconds. And so he's here with us today in the basement of the Roseland Theater chatting about it. As often happens, social justice talk and work happens in the basements with a lot of noise going all around. So Paul L. Mills, thanks for joining Amnesty International and Law and Disorder. We're rooting for you, and we look forward to hopefully hearing a great update in the near future.
Thank you so much.
Law and Disorder recently sat down with convicted civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart to talk about her health, her approaching sentencing this September, and the details leading up to her indictment and conviction. We go now to the second part of that interview.
There's no sense of fairness here. It's about who you can get most easily to send out a strong message. Watch what you say, watch what you do. You better be on our side, or else we're going to squish you.
You know, it's an interesting thing. I find it so in my own political thinking that this administration that wants to know everything about all of us and yet is put up such a wall for us knowing anything about what they're doing or what's going on. Yeah. It's an incredible dichotomy.
They call it state secrets and national security.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
There's no bottom on this.
No.
The more we find out, I mean, we're finding out more and more by the day. First, we found out, you know, the government's just picking people up, throwing them in detention without giving them their constitutional rights, no regard for the Constitution. Then we're looking and the government's waging war here, waging war there. And then we move on and we see the government's pulling people in for questioning and the FBI's using scary intimidation tactics. And then they set up this place in a place where they say it's a legal black hole and they kidnap people from around the world, stick them in there. Then we find out the government's torturing people. Then we find out that the government is sending people, flying people around the world to secret black sites. And then we find out the government's spying on us, that they're listening in to our emails. They're reading your emails, folks, your phone calls. I guarantee you, some of you who are listening have no idea, but it's happening to you. Could be happening to us sitting here in this room. We don't have that sense of privacy and security. We're being watched. And now we find out some of our bank records are being looked on. They're watching your finances, seeing where your money is going and where it's coming from. And this should make everyone really uncomfortable. And the question that I keep asking is, when is it going to be enough? What do they need to do next? Does George Bush need to start knocking down our doors and start telling people individually they will then be next? I mean, what needs to happen for us to wake up? And this is a huge wake-up call for me. This was, I think, one of the most significant post-9/11 events for me, Lynn Stewart's indictment. And I was so, one of my first days at my new job at Amnesty, I walked into a colleague's office. Milo, I'd love it if you'd say hi to him. He has a big, huge picture of you up on his wall. He works with our new media department. You know, you've become a symbol. It's then I realized you become a symbol not only to lawyers out there, lawyers who want to do good work, but to people who care about justice in general and who stand up. You know, Milo puts his efforts, his social justice work, he does it through the internet. And so for people who want to stand up for what's right, you've become a symbol for them too.
Well, that's what we're hoping at the sentencing to bring to this judge. I mean, this one judge, John G. Codall of the Southern District of New York, has it all in his hands. He can send me home or he can put me in jail for 30 years or 45, actually, I think is the statutory limit. But all of this is in his hand, and we're basically, in our sentencing papers, which are going in, as I said, the end of the week, we're making the pitch that my lifetime of service to the underprivileged or to the persons that are underserved in our society and the politically despised should count for something. You know, this is not folks that do charity after the fact. I've done this for a lifetime. I think our papers and the letters, we have almost 1,000 letters. And even it's sort of like attending your funeral, you know, because you read all these wonderful things people are saying about you. But they're just the most wonderful letters from colleagues, from, you know, political figures, from my clients. You know, I'm serving time for murder, but I learned the error of my ways, and I learned it because Lynn Stewart wouldn't let up on me. And she loved me enough to tell me where I had gone wrong and what to do about it. I mean, they're just the most wonderful letters. I have a letter from a young man I represented. His mother was killed in the World Trade Center. And he describes the days after. We spent hours and hours on the phone. He was not a defendant at that point, but we had done something, and then he got arrested thereafter, part of the trauma. And he wrote a wonderful letter. So, I mean, if this judge can look beyond the narrow stricture of what the government expects him to do and really operate independently, which is a problem.
Wouldn't be a career builder if he let you go home.
Yeah, but you know, that's what we need these days. We need people of courage and people of conscience to act on that conscience. It is, you know, I was talking to a New York Times reporter on my way in here from Washington, D.C., and we were talking about how far things have gone. And, you know, as journalists are, he just didn't have a position on this. But, of course, I was telling him mine. I think about Daniel Ellsberg and where are the people like him? He said, I was fully prepared to spend the rest of my life in prison, and I expected it because I had to do what was right. I still had to do it, and I was willing to pay that price. We need people to stand up. It's the time now.
Lynn, if listeners want to get in touch with the Lynn Stewart Defense Committee at your website, what sort of things can people do to help you now? Get your pencils, everybody.
Yes, indeed. We really, I say this and people grin at me, but we really, on the 25th of September, the sentencing day, we're going to have events leading up to it. We particularly are going to have a big rally at Riverside Church on the 24th. And we're really going to hope that people are going to come by bus, by train, by plane, by hush puppy, whatever way you travel, and get down there to Foley Square on that Monday morning. You might be taking a day off from work. You might be taking a day out of your life. But I tell you, I think you'll be able to tell your grandchildren about this one. And it's very, very important, I think, that this judge understand I'm not isolated, that I have people that care very much what happens and that they will take out a day of their lives to come down there just as they wrote letters, just as they attended the trial. This is a different focus. This is on Lynn Stewart, the woman, and saying our community cannot do without her. I keep joking and I say I want Foley Square to look like St. Peter's Square in Rome on Easter Sunday when the Pope comes out. I want people to just fill up that square, fill up the roads around it, really give the security guys angst and agita. And I don't mean that by doing anything. I mean just by their sheer numbers, of course. Fill up Tom Paine Park, which is right across the street from the court. Fill it up and say, we're here for Lynn. We're watching you, Judge. We're not. Whatever you do, we've got our eye on you.
And we'll be there. All four of us will be there, so look for us.
And Lynn, what's your website?
Okay, the website is Lynn Stewart, that's L-Y-N-N-E, Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, .org, and it's usually got what's going on currently. It has all the transcripts. It has book reviews, because when I was ill, I was reading so much that I wrote book reviews of the things I was reading. And it's nice. It's really lovely. We're helped in that with Ian Head from the Guild helps us with that. And it's really
he's a great webmaster.
Wonderful.
And people should check that website a week or so before the sentencing date just to make sure they're current on
Absolutely.
What's happening with the get-togethers.
And tune into WBAI. We try to keep people current through the radio station of events, of things that are going on, of where things are at.
And so go to lawanddisorder.org. We'll keep you updated so you can check on our website for information on Lynn Stewart.
Lynn, it was a joy to have you with us once again.
We are with you in solidarity. This is a case that tugs at our hearts like other cases don't.
I think the proudest thing for me is the lawyers, the young lawyers who come up to me and say, I went to law school because I want to be like you. And the other ones who say, I think I want to go to law school, but what do you think? Do you think it's, and I say, if you got the drive, you've got to do it. The fire in your belly to go in there and take them on, this is where it's at. That's what our job is. It's a wonderful profession. They can't punish me any more than they have already by taking away my ability to be in the courtroom. I miss it terribly. Anything after that is small potatoes.
Lynn Stewart, thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.